Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We'll go ahead and get started. My name is not Jan Vernick, if you were expecting to see Jan Vernick as the moderator here. That's not me. I'm Jeff Swanson, and I'm here from the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Duke University Medical School. There's been a little change in our cast of characters this afternoon, pursuant to the Frankenstorm and some of our folks coming from the East Coast. It's too bad they didn't come because we've got beautiful weather here in San Francisco, but we don't have Josh Horowitz and we don't have Richard Bonney, but we do have a wonderful, nice crowd here of hopefully interested people in this topic of gun laws and mental illness and violence, a conversation at the intersection of law, policy, and research. So as the first presenter, I'm going to give a little bit of an overview and a little bit of background information, and then I'd like to present some new research findings from our group's study in Connecticut, one of three states, on whether laws designed to restrict firearms access for people with serious mental illness actually work and whether they actually confer some public safety benefit or not. After I speak for a little longer than would be my slot, since I'm going to try to present some of Josh Horowitz's background information, we will hear from Dr. Renee Binder, who is a psychiatrist from right here in San Francisco. Dr. Binder is the founder and director of the program in law and psychiatry here at the University of California in San Francisco, and she's an expert in law and psychiatry and in assessment of risk of violence and suicide and civil commitment and a number of other legal issues. And she's going to talk to us really from a clinician's perspective about issues involving violence risk and people with mental illness. And then following Dr. Binder's presentation, we're going to hear from my colleague, Professor Philip Cook from Duke. And Professor Cook is an economist who's been at Duke for many, many years. He is the ITT Terry Sanford Professor of Public Policy at the Terry Sanford Institute of Public Policy, School of Public Policy. It used to be an institute, and thanks to Phil, it is. And he's also a distinguished professor of economics and sociology, and really literally wrote the book on the problem of gun violence in the United States and the cost of it, and both the social and economic cost. And so Phil is going to kind of be a responder and also present some information of his own and trying to understand sort of the logic and what the empirical findings show and tell us. So, firearms laws, mental illness, and violence. So what we're doing today is focusing on people with mental illness as a special population of interest concerning the risk of violence, and I might say something about the public perception of violence and mental illness in juxtaposition to or in contrast to what the research evidence says, because those might be two very different things. Then we're going to talk a little bit about the federal laws, kind of in broad terms, that restrict access to guns for people with mental illness and what some of the challenges are to states that try to implement those laws, those restrictions, specifically insofar as they require a search of administrative records for the purpose of doing a background check and the problem of doing that, given the way records are and so on. Then we're going to get to our research from Connecticut, which is sort of an evaluation of whether these laws actually work anyway, and can we see any evidence of that, and what might be the policy implications, whatever we find. And maybe you could help us with some of that in the discussion, period. I have no relationships to disclose, at least none that would be relevant in this context. And I'd like to gratefully acknowledge in passing our sponsorship by the National Science Foundation, the program on law and social science and the sociology program, and also the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation program on public health law research. We have a cast of characters, distinguished collaborators I'd like to just mention in passing, who have come together to work on this project at Duke: Allison Gilbert Robertson, who's right here in the audience, my colleague Phil Cook, who's also here, Marvin Swartz at our Connecticut site, Dr. Linda Frisman, who's also here in the audience, and going to keep me honest here, Cheru Lin and Mike Michael Norco, and in New York, Paul Applebaum, Grace Lee, and in Massachusetts, Bill Fisher, Deborah Pinels, Al Grudzinskas and Ira Packer. So let me begin by putting the U.S. gun violence problem, the sort of public safety burden, in perspective. I think everyone in this room has been to our National Mall, and you've seen what a sobering sight it is to observe 58,000 names engraved on a granite wall. And that is the number of United States military personnel who died over the 10 years of the Vietnam War. Now let me ask you to imagine, what if we were to build a monument to commemorate, to remember all the people who have died as the result of a gunshot in the United States in the past 10 years, for which we have data from the CDC. And that monument would be five times larger than the Vietnam Memorial. 306,946 people have died as a result of the gunshot in the last 10 years. That would be a very large granite wall. Now, about 39% of those are homicides. 57%, larger proportion, are suicides. If we were to hypothetically reduce that number by removing the attributable risk, the estimated attributable risk that's associated with mental illness as a unique risk factor, we could conceivably bring that number down to 207,000. That's making some assumptions. It's kind of a rough estimate. But most of that reduction would be, about 95% of that would be reductions in suicide, because the homicide rate, really, mental illness is a very minor contributor, only about 4 to 5% attributable risk. So I'm making this point about suicide initially in order to say that is a big kind of unexplored dimension. It's kind of the elephant in the room when we talk about gun control, firearms policy, people with mental illness, because most of the conversation, particularly the loudest conversation, has to do with homicide and assault and mass shootings and so on. And I'm actually going to be talking about violence towards others. But bear in mind, in the back of your mind, that suicide is probably a bigger issue with respect to the connection to mental health risk factors. So what's the recipe for gun violence? What is the, for this terrible problem? What are the ingredients of it? And what ingredients could the law actually be deployed as a lever to try to remove? Well, I guess the simplest, and this is much simpler than Josh Horowitz would put it. He's a lawyer, and he'd probably use a lot more words, but this is my picture of what Josh would say. You have dangerous people, and you have guns. I mean, there's more than that. There's markets, and there's social determinants of aggressive behavior and all of that. But really, the law kind of thinks about, well, there's dangerous people. If you didn't have the guns, you could have a dangerous person, but they wouldn't use a gun and it might not be as lethal. On the other hand, you had a gun, and if you didn't have someone inclined to use it to harm someone else or him or herself, then you also would not have the equation. Well, this is what a lot of our peer countries have done. Okay, let's just regulate the guns. Let's restrict the guns. Let's make it very difficult for an ordinary citizen to have a gun, for their protection. It's just too dangerous. And, they still have aggression, and people still try to hurt each other, but they have far lower homicide rates than we do because the means are less lethal. We've actually tried this, too. The D.C. Firearms Control Regulation Act banned handguns and instituted a lot of other restrictions on guns in D.C. There's some very good evidence to show that it significantly reduced homicide and suicide in D.C. It didn't work in the surrounding areas of Maryland and Virginia. It didn't affect non-gun violence, but it affected gun-related suicide and homicide. Problem is, this is what our United States Supreme Court, in their interpretation of the Constitution, the Second Amendment to the Constitution, is that a handgun ban like that is unconstitutional. So, in the decision of D.C. versus Heller, and extended also in the Chicago decision and the McDonald decision, basically. Now, the kind of starting point, the framework that we start with in thinking about policy to restrict firearms in relation to people with mental illness is that first there's a constitutional right at stake. So, they have affirmed the Supreme Court decisions that the Constitution confers an individual right to keep and bear arms. Now, it's not an unlimited right, and that's where the however comes in. So, they left in place the longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill. So what that really means, I think, is that the court is saying that we have a problem with gun violence, okay, but we can't really solve it by broadly restricting the public's access to dangerous guns. Instead, we have to focus on trying to figure out who are the people who should not have them. And that's where it gets very complicated. So just in broad terms here, brushstrokes, the federal law categorically excludes some people with mental illness from purchasing or possessing firearms. That means by just being a member of a category of having been involuntarily committed, it doesn't have to do with an assessment of an individual risk level, but being in that category. So some legal benchmarks, 1968, after the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, the Gun Control Act was passed, and that instituted the mental health exclusions, and which are these, involuntarily committed to a mental institution, and then this term adjudicated as a mental defective. It's a very infelicitous term, and it's offensive to some people. It's not hard to see why. It doesn't really mean anything clinically. I think Dr. Binder would tell you that it doesn't mean much clinically, but what it means legally really is that there is a legal authority of some kind or that has determined that a person with, as a result of mental illness or some other conditions, is a danger to self or others, incompetent to handle their own affairs, or not guilty by reason of insanity in a criminal matter, or found incompetent to stand trial. That was sort of about establishing the criteria. The Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act, named after Jim Brady, who was Ronald Reagan's press secretary and was shot by John Hinckley in 1980, really was about enforcement. How do you enforce those criteria? So it instituted background checks, and it also set in motion what would become the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, which was actually initiated in 1998, the idea of a national registry, that these records could be deposited there, a repository that could be searched to find out if someone met these criteria. Otherwise, it was up to the individual who's trying to buy a gun, and if they say, no, I have never been involuntarily committed, there was no other way to tell. So what does this mean? Well, most people out there in the public, if they think about mental illness and gun violence, these are the images that come to mind. The mass shooters, people who are mentally disturbed young men who were somehow able legally to get guns and killed multiple people, and for completely irrational reasons, and this is the idea, this is the kind of the stereotype of gun violence and mental illness. And so, partly that kind of idea and the profoundly disturbing nature of that and all the attention it got is what has driven the next emphasis in the law, which is the National Instant Check System Improvement Act. And that the idea there was to try to make it mandatory for states to report their mental health records to the NICS. It had been voluntary, and very few states had actually done it. So the NICS Improvement Act, essentially DOJ gives grants to states to improve and transmit their records, and they don't qualify for the funds if they don't do it. And then it's kind of a sweetener or something. The NRA backed this idea that if this were to be passed, then also people could get their gun rights restored. And so states are required, in order to participate in this, to institute what's called a relief from disabilities program, whereby they have to consider and grant restoration of firearms. And this is an interesting policy issue because states are struggling with how to do this. Do you see this to the mental health authority and, ask people like Dr. Binder to say, okay, you're good to go, here's your gun, or they don't really want to do that, or do you say it has to be a judicial proceeding? And if so, what evidence do you need to bring to bear in that proceeding and so on? Only 9 states have done this so far. Maybe it's a little more than that. But there's a lot of attention now to this NICS. This is the thing to do. The assumption being if we get everybody's records in there, that is going to give us some hope of reducing gun violence. It has dramatically increased the number of mental health records that are in that national check system that's checked by the federal firearms licensees. It's now up to over 1 million. And as I say, this has gotten a lot of attention. After the terrible shooting in the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, the Mayors Against Gun Violence came out with this interactive map online and, can dangerous people buy guns in your state? And you can click on your state, like here's Connecticut, and you find out that Connecticut has reported 12,300 records, but if they were really good and they were up on par with the best reporting states, they should have 17,602 records in there. Well, the problem with this, it assumes that mental illness and getting these records into the NICS is going to help solve this problem. And there's actually very little evidence that that's so. There is some intriguing evidence kind of that would make you question it, which is that you know, of all of the federal denials, denials on the basis of mental health prohibitors account for only 1.4%. You know, there's a lot of records, over 1 million mental health disqualifying records, and this is a burden for states to do this and manage all this, and only 6,000 have been denied, 0.6%. So, you know, the problem with these criteria, and this is the federal, you know, regulation, adjudicated mental defect, as I said, it doesn't apply in the abstract to mental illness or symptoms just floating out there in hyperspace. It applies to real people who have mental illness, but they also vary a lot in all kinds of other risk factors and their exposure to, you know, environments that might raise or lower the risk. You know, I mean, people with mental illness might range from your harmless grandmother to your neighbor's not-so-harmless intoxicated boyfriend and everything in between. They're people. Obviously, we are people. So how does this map on to, you know, when you take the law and you try to see how it applies in real data? So this is kind of intriguing. These are data from the NIMH Epidemiologic Catchment Area Surveys. These are representative data from the community. And these bars here represent permutations of lifetime history of psychiatric hospitalization, arrest, and both. And so over here, you know, on the right, and the reason psychiatric hospitalization is interesting is it's correlated with the gun disqualifying involuntary commitment criteria. So over there on the right, the little red squared says 2%. Those are people who have a history of psychiatric hospitalization, but in the current year, they don't meet criteria for mental illness or substance abuse. They have recovered, they're in remission, right? So the whether or not, and as you move to people who currently have mental illness, it goes up to 8%. People who have mental illness and substance abuse, it goes up to 21%. And then over here, if you add this demographic group and you say, in addition, let's make them male and young and have a lower socioeconomic status, then the risk goes up to 40%. And of course, the law, you know, doesn't have anything to say about those, but just to show that there is variability, and each of those is significant in a multivariable model. So, you know, it's higher if you add arrest history as well. But again, you know, there's a 15% increase associated with these demographic factors. So the problem here is, in terms of how the law works, is that these criteria could be both under-inclusive and over-inclusive. You know, over there on the right, you might say they're under-inclusive in the sense, and not that we want to pass a law saying that, you know, if you were young and male and poor, that you would be somehow legally disqualified from anything. But on the other hand, if the idea of the law is to catch or capture people who have risk of violence, well, it's not going to capture those people because they've never been hospitalized. They do have mental illness. And over on the left, it could be over-inclusive. You have false positive. You scoop up lots of people who have a commitment history, maybe for being incompetent or something, but have almost zero risk of violence. Looking at it another way, this is some data on 331 people who've actually been involuntarily committed. So they would be categorically disqualified from purchasing or possessing a gun. This is from North Carolina. That lifesaver there in the middle, I'm going to show you what those things in the pie chart are. So about a third of those individuals who've been committed have made no threat or violent act at all. 17% have made verbal threats only, and 32% have committed an act you might call simple battery, but they did not use a weapon, and they did not cause injury. And I see Hank Stedman and Pam Robbins, they should know what these criteria mean because they basically invented them, but that's what we're talking about. And now if you take this group here, 18% of this big group of people have been involuntarily hospitalized, committed a serious violent act. But break that out further, 66% or 13% of the total had a weapon in hand, but they didn't cause any injury. 14% or 2% of the total injured someone without a weapon. And down here, this little square, which is 3% of the total of this involuntarily committed group of people, committed an act in which they injured someone with a weapon. And so that's the stereotype, but it's actually a very small proportion even of people who have been involuntarily committed. To look at this yet another way, so these are data from a meta-analysis of all the studies that have been done estimating the prevalence of mental illness sorted by the setting in which the study was done. So here, that group there, in represented by the red triangle, are people who have been involuntarily committed as inpatients. And on average, the studies suggest 36% have been violent in the past 6 months or year. A couple of them were year estimates, but you can see relative to the others that it's relatively on the high side. Now, if you start over there on the left and you go from outpatients in treatment to representative community samples, discharged inpatients, and then people who presented in an emergency department because they're in a psychiatric emergency, maybe they're there because they're violent, it goes up. Now, so the problem is that these settings don't just necessarily represent different populations. They could be the same people at different stages of illness and treatment. So, these are people over here who, this is the first episode psychosis. They might not have established any mental health record at all. This might be the first time they come in. They might not have a criminal record. But they might, be these individuals in the future. And the gun disqualifier is permanent, unless you have a, restoration policy. But there's another problem. Even if you think that involuntary commitment or mental health adjudication is the right marker for violence, there's wide variability in states in their use of involuntary commitment. So, this is the percentage of the state hospital population in California, 17% are involuntary. In North Carolina, it's 95%. They don't have different illnesses. They have different state policies. And North Carolina, involuntary commitment probably has little to do with dangerousness. It has to do with transportation and how people are actually transported to the regional psychiatric facility. So, the corollary to this is that, patients in different states would be legally disqualified or not based on their dangers, but based on their state's policy in using involuntary commitment, and also whether you're in a state where the court reports the record to the National Instant Check System rather than the treatment system. Because like in New York, if you get committed to a public hospital, you will have that record reported to the National Instant Check System. If you get committed to a private hospital, you will not. Just so there are those kinds of inequities and disparities. So this is a problem ready-made for research. There's all kinds of questions about it, and then so it's where you can simply be sure that the research that you produce is going to have some implication for policy, because the policy issues are kind of driving the research. So what we wanted to do with our study is sort of interrogate three assumptions underlying our federal firearms laws. And the first is that there actually is a strong association between mental illness and gun violence. There would be a much higher rate of it in the people with SMI than in the general public. I mean, if that's not so, well, then the criteria are, problematic and probably unfair on their face. Second, that our extant gun disqualifying legal criteria can actually accurately identify people, the subgroup of mentally ill individuals at risk. And third, that the policies that we have to implement and enforce these things, will actually be effective in reducing firearms-related violence and suicide. I mean, that's the point. There are other issues in terms of, like, what's the burden and cost of doing it, but these are sort of three things that we wanted to investigate. So our study is done in three states, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New York, and the idea was to get big samples of people who had serious mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or major depression, at least one psychiatric hospital admission, because we wanted to kind of level the playing field and be comparing people who at least had some common level of severity, at least enough to have an inpatient treatment. And then we had to have a period of time, so we have like 8 to 10 years of time, and then we matched and merged all of these records. And Dr. Frisman can tell you what an ordeal this is to do, because in Connecticut, but she really put this together and got all this for us. And so we have psychiatric hospital admission records, we have court records of gun disqualifying mental health adjudications, criminal records. Then we have, for the outcome, arrests for gun crimes and violent crimes. In New York, we're going to have suicide records from the Vital Statistics Department, and then do this big kind of quasi-experimental analysis, which is what we're going to do. So that's the data matrix there. So you can see these are how our data are structured. So the rows here are correspond to person periods. So, we've got Fred and Alice and Jack, and each of them has months 1 through 96. And you stack those all up, and they amount to 2.2 million person month records. And the columns are variables, and some of them are fixed. They don't change, like people's gender usually doesn't change over the course of the study. And then we have things like that vary from month to month. Like in that month, in that given month, was that a month when someone was disqualified from buying a gun on the basis of their criminal record, their mental health record, or both? And we know that. It's a switch that's on or off. So then we ask, you know, as a function of all those things, did the probability of committing a violent crime or a gun crime go up or down? Now, you might look at that and say, well, the big problem is, you know, that things can happen in the same month and you can't tell what's the cause and what's the effect. Well, so what we did about that is we lagged the outcome. That's what the matrix is. It lets you go backwards in time. And what you do is you line up month one with the independent variables to month two with the outcome so that we can be sure that we're looking at what happened. You know, the predictor would be in gun crime in the future. The gun crime you commit now is going to disqualify you, but that's not going to be bound up in what we're associating with it in the models. All right, so to the data, here is some demographic and diagnostic characteristics. About 64% were under age 40. We had a disproportionately male sample for reasons I'm not entirely sure. A racial distribution, 62% non-Hispanic white, 18% African-American, 16.6% Hispanic, and other ethnicities. And schizophrenia, 28%, bipolar disorder, 30.6%, and about 41% with major depression. So what about the percentage of people who had gun disqualifying records? So we had 23,292 unique individuals with at least one hospitalization over these years. Of that group, 60% were not disqualified either on their criminal or their mental health background. 32.7% were disqualified on the basis of a criminal record, either a felony or if not a drug-related offense that was a misdemeanor drug offense because that counts, or a domestic violence offense, a restraining order, but 32.7% had a disqualifying criminal record over that period of time. 4.8% had a disqualifying mental health adjudication history. And 2.2% had both, so that's the overlap. And in those people's case, it would be redundant because both records would be reported to the NICS. Now, if you think about it, the model is actually not working on people. It's working on person periods. So it's also relevant to look at what percentage of the time in the model, you know, are in these categories. And so here, because some people might have their, you know, disqualifying event very late in the series and not have the whole period of time exposed to that. So here, about, you know, three-quarters were not disqualified. 20% had the criminal only. 7.3% had the mental health history only, because they probably had that for a longer period of time. That's why it's a little different than the previous one. And 1.1% had both. All right, so here we have the outcome variable. This is the prevalence of gun crime and violent crime in the sample. So we kind of, you know, cross-tabulated guns and violence here in our crime outcome. So 211 people, almost 1%, had a gun arrest but no violent charge. 25% had a violence arrest over the 8 years, but no gun charge. And then 1.6%, 364 people had guns and violence, but not necessarily at the same time. It could have been two different charges. And then 337 people, or 1.5% of the 23,000, had a violent gun crime arrest. Now, you know, any violent crime, and then any violent crime, if you annualize this, if you say, okay, well, let's just assume that it's kind of different people each month, let's divide it by eight and factor it as a rate per 100,000, that allows you to compare to some state rates. So the United States rate that you get if you look it up on the FBI website is 466.9 per 100,000 arrested for a violent crime. And in Connecticut, it's a little lower than that. So you can see on the face of it here, this selected sample of people with severe mental illness had a far higher rate. This is interesting, kind of tantalizing evidence. If you look at the people who were and were not disqualified from buying a gun on the basis of their mental health history, there is a significant relationship. There's a significant effect between the not disqualified and disqualified in non-gun crime. And so if you think that the law is only going to work when there's a gun involved, you would expect this. You'd expect that that there'd be a higher rate for the people who had been committed involuntarily simply because the commitment criteria involved dangerousness. So that's the sort of the counterfactual there. But over here with the gun-related crime, there's no difference. So you might hypothesize that if the law weren't working at all, that the purple bar on the far right would be higher in the same proportion as the over there on the left with the non-gun crime. But in order to test this, of course, we need to use a multi-variable longitudinal statistical model, which we're going to do. All right, so what patterns would we expect to see in the data? There's no law and there's no policy at all. This is the counterfactual. You would expect that these two red bars here, people disqualified for their mental health history, would have higher violence rate. They would have an odds ratio elevated because they've been committed and dangerousness involved in those criteria. And the blue bars are their counterparts who have not been. So if you think the law might work even without the policy, you'd expect that elevated risk to be dropped down to the same across the board there. If you think, well, the law would work, but only if the policies in effect reporting the records of the NICS, you might expect something like that. So, if you have the disqualifying record, but nobody knows about it because it's not in the repository, you'd see it like that. And then there might be something like this, where you'd have partly an effect of the law, part of the policy, and it would bring it down like that. Well, what did we actually find? You might be surprised. Here's a big regression model, but I'm going to pull out some certain things in it. So first off, let's look at this is a logistic regression model for repeated measures run on the outcome of any firearm-related crime, any gun crime, and on 2.2 million observations. So first off, this variable shows you, if you had hoped that having a gun disqualifying criminal record would deter you from future gun crime, that doesn't seem to be working. And actually what happens is they are more likely, people who have been disqualified on the basis of their criminal record are 1.8 times more likely to be arrested for a gun crime in the future. I mean, that could indicate that that basically people who have a criminal record that disqualifies them, if they're going to get a gun, would probably get it on the secondary market and not go to a federal firearms licensee to try to buy it. Here, this is interesting, all these covariates are significant. So being younger, being male, African American or Hispanic, which is a proxy for all kinds of social disadvantage, I would suspect, in Connecticut, having a co-occurring substance abuse disorder and not having schizophrenia. Now, the people who involved with the MacArthur Risk Study should perk up on that, because that's exactly what they found. Actually, having schizophrenia in this comparative framework is a, quote, protective factor compared to people with mood disorders. But all these things significantly predicted gun crime in the future. And so, these are the kinds of things that are associated with criminal offending, arguably in other populations that don't have mental illness. In terms of what we found with the mental health adjudication factors, well, nothing significant there. There is a point estimate of 0.8, that's in the right direction, that you would expect the people who are legally disqualified after the NICS reporting policy goes into effect to have a little lower odds ratio, and they did, but there's wild confidence intervals around it, and it's not statistically significant. So we tested several variations on gun crime outcomes. We looked at any violent crime with a gun. We looked at any violent crime without a gun. We looked at any violent crime, gun or no gun, and we found the same pattern of results. So back to this. Now, this is what we actually found. These are the odds ratios of these four groups, disqualified before NICS, disqualified after, and not disqualified before and after. So I guess if you kind of squint a little bit, you might think that this is suggestive that it may be working, that there's some little bit of a decrease there in the disqualified after the NICS. It could also mean that the law is applying to people who aren't really at risk in the first place, that it's not capturing the right people. And so you wouldn't really expect a law to work if it's not working on people that are the relevant population. All right, so I'm going to stop now, but let me just say in summary, I think I'd say at least now, I mean, this is kind of unfolding, but that we do know gun violence is a major public health problem in the United States, and mental illness in general is a small part of it, with the exception of suicide, which I started with. And violence, if you start with violence, is a complex phenomenon that has a lot of different, it's kind of multi-determined, and it's embedded in a social context, and our policy solutions have to be also similarly nuanced. The federal laws that are designed to restrict access to dangerous people could be both under-inclusive and over-inclusive. You could get people with involuntary commitment who won't be violent, and you could also get there are many violent individuals with mental illness who don't have a commitment history and wouldn't be touched by this law. The variability in commitment laws and how they're applied, as well as the variability in state policies regarding reporting mental health records to the NICS, make it hard to evaluate, at least now, whether gun restrictions on people with mental illness are effective. And we hope to have more information when we have our New York sample and our Massachusetts sample to bring to bear. So I'm going to stop there and introduce Dr. Renee Binder. And I think what I'd like to do is wait and hold questions until the end, and we'll leave lots of time at the end. And so, Dr. Binder, thank you.
So I'm going to be having a clinical perspective. I work at University of California, San Francisco, and I was the director of the inpatient unit there for 22 years, and I still consult up there. So we saw a lot of patients who were committed either as a danger to themselves or a danger to others, and then in 1990, the California law was passed. And so I'll talk about some of the differences before the law was passed and after the law was passed. I have nothing to disclose. So I'm going to start with a case example, talk a little bit about suicide and guns, violence and mental illness, what the source of guns are when violent crimes are committed, and then really get into the California law and its clinical applications, and then a little bit about some of the studies we've done on patients who carry weapons and what the effect of weapon screening policies are in psychiatric emergency rooms. So Jeff spoke about public perception, and I think we all know there is a public perception about mental illness, and it's based on the media reports. I thought it was interesting that in the second presidential debate, one of the questions was about gun control, and both President Obama and Governor Romney both said, well, of course we're not for guns for people who are mentally ill. So whoever gets elected, I think some of these policies will continue. But this is from media reports. Lisa Dwee, 24 years old, diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia with command auditory hallucinations. She was committed as a danger to others for 90 days. 1 year earlier, after threatening to kill an FBI agent related to delusions that the television station was broadcasting information about her sex life. Then, in January of 1999, she bought a 9mm semi-automatic. She actually bought it legally, but when she was asked questions about whether she had ever been committed, she just said no. And then she walked into the television station, KSL, fired the weapon 48 times, killed the young mother, and wounded the building manager. And there are many, many cases like this. I didn't want to spend a lot of time, but it really does add to the public perception of what are we doing having people with major mental illness have guns so that they commit these horrific crimes on innocent victims. As Jeff mentioned, part of the issue also relates to suicide, which hasn't, in the policy, there's not so much of an emphasis on suicide as it is on violence, but suicide is a real issue. So people with mental illness are 10 to 15 times more likely to commit suicide than the general public, and a significant proportion of suicides may be impulsive. Guns are the most common method used in fatal suicide attempts. The other fatal methods are hanging and, in this community, jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge or other bridges. And a strong risk factor for suicide is a previous suicide attempt. So the question is, if someone has had a previous suicide attempt, is hospitalized, why do we want to give them a gun? Why do we want to allow them to have a gun? They'll likely become depressed again because it's a recurrent illness. They're likely to feel suicidal at some point in their life, and we don't want them to have a gun where they can act on it impulsively. In terms of statistics about violence and mental illness, So 3 to 5% of violence in the United States is perpetrated by individuals with mental illness. Of course, what that means is it's only 3 to 5%, and you know, 95 to 97% of violent crimes are committed by people without mental illness. But for certain kinds of violence, and for example, for rampage killers, it's 50% had a history of mental illness, and 8% had been committed. So in the criminology statistics, people talk about serial killers, where there's a series of crimes that are separated by time and location. There are the mass murderers, so those are people who take out an assault weapon, and it's all in one location. And then the term rampage killers refers to people who are doing it at the same time but in different locations. So the Columbine killers would be an example of that. To go and the Virginia Tech would be another example. So it's various locations, but it's all more or less at the same time. And when people look at the characteristics of these murderers, they say that rampage killers are more likely to have a history of mental illness. The gun source in these rampage killings, and this is a study of 75, mainly from media accounts, is that 56% of them got the guns legally. You know, 13% were illegal, 16% were bought by lying on an application, and 15% were borrowed or stolen from a family or friend. But 56% actually went into a store and got them legally, and these are, again, people with a history of mental illness. Jeff spoke about, he showed photos of some of the recent cases and said that these guns were gotten legally. So Jared Loeffner was the man in Arizona who shot Gabrielle Giffords, killed other people, and he bought a Glock 9mm semi-automatic pistol from a federally licensed gun retailer in Arizona. Of course, this was legal because he hadn't been in any court-ordered treatment. And then Seng-Hee Cho from Virginia Tech, he actually had been in court-ordered treatment, but the record was never sent to the background check system. And so in Virginia, there's been a lot of work to see that this doesn't happen anymore. So let me talk about the California law. So this was passed in 1990. It's part of the Welfare and Institutions Code. That's the code that we use in California for all of the statutes related to psychiatric hospitalization and psychiatric patients. So for persons based on 72-hour holds for danger to self to danger to others, and we use 72 hours as the initial period of involuntary detainment. So there is prohibition from owning, possessing, receiving, or purchasing guns for 5 years from the admission date. There is the right to petition in superior court for restoration of the right to purchase or possess firearms. Can request a hearing at discharge, and if the patient requests a hearing, is forwarded to the superior court or during a 5-year period by calling the Department of Justice. And actually, as we discharge patients from the hospital, we give them a document that says that they're restricted from owning, possessing, receiving, or purchasing guns, and that they have the right to a hearing, and they're asked, if you want a hearing, you can request it. And just to give you some of the other categories in California of people who are prohibited from possessing firearms, so persons convicted of a felony or who's a fugitive from justice, person under indictment, someone who's addicted to drugs, juveniles who are or were wards of the juvenile court for a crime committed, they cannot own a firearm until age 30, a person under a restraining order, and the restraining orders are often used for domestic violence situations, persons who are incompetent to stand trial, not guilty by reason of insanity, or a mentally disordered sex offender, persons who are under a conservatorship, and then this the last category relates to the Tarasoff threat. So a person who communicates a threat to a licensed psychotherapist and is reported to law enforcement cannot possess a firearm for 6 months. So the statute related to duty protect in California is that you feel that the person is a serious threat, not imminent threat, not general threat, is a serious threat of committing violence against committing violence against a reasonably identifiable victim. And then in California, in order to discharge the duty, there you report it to law enforcement. And then if you can, you try and locate the victim. Often we actually just call the police department and they take a report. And we sometimes can't contact the victim, but they can try and look for that. But anyone who does that cannot possess a firearm for 6 months. So my perspective is that in some ways, after this law was passed, it was helpful clinically. And the reason why I say that is because before it was passed, patients have guns, and the family would report that they would have a gun. And then there was this very difficult conversation with the patient where you'd say, you know, we really need to do something about the gun. And the patient would say, doctor, I don't want to do anything about the gun. I need the gun. And you'd say, well, we need to call one of your relatives to come and get it, or we need to call the police about it. And the patient would say, wait a minute, you know, I came here for treatment. I'm in a psychiatric hospital. How dare you try and take my gun away from me? And I always felt I was the bad guy. I mean, I felt I was doing God's work trying to protect people. But it was a very difficult conversation I'm having with patients, that I was trying to keep them away from their gun. And it was interesting because it sort of shifted a little after this law was passed. It was much easier to develop a therapeutic alliance with the patient. We'd say, you know, I have to inform you of the fact that there's this law in California. It's not my law, but I have to inform you that you cannot possess a gun, you know, or purchase a gun. Doctor, how could you say that? Well, I'm not the one who's saying it. As a physician in California who's treating you, I have this obligation to report it. You know, and then if the patient gets angry, they get angry at the legislature. They get angry at the law, but they don't get angry with me. So in some ways, it's been helpful. I was thinking about this. My older sister is a pediatrician, and actually when she did her residency, there were not child abuse reporting laws in her state. And I remember she would say to me, you'd see this child and you thought they were abused. They had burns on their body, and the parents would say, no, you know, and it often came up also even with upper middle class, you know, families, and they'd say, no, you know, the baby got scalded in the bathtub, you know, fell. And then it was, what do you do about it? And are you going to ruin the reputation of this family? Are you going to call Child Protective Services? Are you going to ruin your relationship, you know, with this family? And she said to me that once there were the child abuse reporting laws, which, of course, now are in all 50 states, in some ways it was a lot easier. There are civil penalties and there are criminal penalties if you don't report child abuse. And it was just taken out of this arena. Well, do we really think they're abusing the kid? And, you know, are we really going to report them and have the authorities go to their house? And maybe, you know, it's just, there was always these big discussions with the attendings in terms of what do you do with this particular kid. And then once there was mandated reporting, it just didn't happen anymore. And in some ways, it's similar. I mean, the standard of care of removal of the guns is maintained. But again, it was not between me and the patient. It was between this legislature, the law, and the patient. I still get consult questions about what to do about guns. And the last few months, I've gotten a couple of questions, and I thought I would share it with you. So an outpatient psychiatrist called me and said, I just want to run this by you, Renee. You know, what do you think about this? And so the patient has chronic suicidality. The therapist said he's not acutely suicidal. I mean, there's no reason to hospitalize him, but I'm always worried about it, that he might actually kill himself. And he's in therapy, and we're working on it. The patient has the gun at home. I've discussed it with the patient that it's probably not a good idea to have the gun at home, especially, as we said before, sometimes suicide attempts are impulsive, and you just don't want to have something that you can use that's going to be fatal right at home. And the patient says, no, I hear what you're saying, doctor, but I want to keep the gun to protect myself from intruders. So the therapist had a lot of discussions with the patient and advised the patient, I really think you should get rid of the gun. And the patient said, well, thank you for your opinion, for your advice, but I'm going to do what I want. So the consult question to me was, is there anything else that can be done about this? And the answer is?
Yes.
Someone said yes?
Yes.
What's yes? So the comment was that, yes, because the person is a danger to themselves, but actually the California law is there is nothing you can do about it. If you feel that the person is a danger to themselves and they need involuntary hospitalization on the basis of mental illness, then these laws kick in. But actually, nothing can be done about this, and that was the advice. Just, you know, keep talking to the patient, and if there are other people in the support system, you might talk to them. But the law is that you cannot take that away from the patient. And then a couple of weeks ago, I received this consult question from our inpatient unit. Each question I also learn about in terms of, you know, just how to think about it. So there was a patient on the inpatient unit who was admitted as a danger to themselves, and they were put on the 72-hour hold. And the patient noted on the history that there were guns at home. So on discharge, the patient was notified that she has to relinquish the guns. This is the California law. You can't possess the guns. And the patient says, well, I don't want to do it. You know, I need my guns. And then so the inpatient staff said, well, this is California law, and you cannot have the gun at home. You cannot possess and own the gun, so you need to do something about it. So the patient says, a friend of mine is going to take the guns. And so the staff said, well, that's okay, you know, to give it with a friend, but we need to confirm it. Can you give us the name of your friend or some contact information? And the patient said, no, I'm not going to give you the name. I'm not going to give you the contact information. So we called the police, and they said, essentially, you know, thank you for calling us, but there's nothing we can do about it either. You know, they said that they could go to the patient's home and say, we're here, we understand that you were admitted as a danger to yourself, and as you know, California law, you cannot have any guns at home, but that the police are not going to go into the home and search it. If the patient lets them in, that's fine. If the patient voluntarily relinquishes the gun, that's fine. But otherwise, the police say, we're not going to do this. So there are limitations to the law. So I just thought I'd end just with a couple of studies that were published a while ago. You know, the whole issue is who carries weapons when people come for help. And what we found is actually quite a few patients carry weapons. Now, this is in San Francisco. I would imagine, Jeff and I were talking about how, in terms of guns, there are really regional differences. As far as I know, most of my friends and colleagues don't have guns at home. I mean, especially if they're living in the Bay Area. Maybe some do when they're in the rural area. But we had a resident who was from Texas. She said everybody had a gun. I mean, everyone that she knew. I mean, there were just differences. So this is in San Francisco. And what we found was people, now this emergency room, let me also say, this was not an inner city emergency room. This was the emergency room at Langley Porter Hospital, which is located in a middle class area right in the middle of San Francisco. And 4% of patients had some kind of weapon. They had knives, some had guns, razor blades, heavy chains, mace, a meat cleaver, and that the patients who held these weapons were quite heterogeneous in demographic and clinical attributes. One of the residents was evaluating an elderly woman who came in to talk because she was feeling depressed, and we had a weapon screening policy, and we had her open her purse, and there was a gun in the purse. It's kind of like not exactly the kind of, you know, person, if you were just identifying, there are five people here, who do you think is carrying a gun? And she was carrying a gun. So you never know what kind of weapons people are having. Men and patients with a history of drug or alcohol abuse were more likely to have weapons. And then we also did a study where we instituted a weapon screening policy in the emergency room. In those days, it was actually unusual to do that. I mean, since that time, there's been some gun violence in emergency rooms. Certainly at San Francisco General, you have to go through weapon detectors, and in big emergency rooms, you have to go through a metal detector, have someone security person make sure that you're not carrying any metal. But years ago, people did not want to have any kind of a weapon screening procedure. They thought that it would, unless there was a reason to suspect someone, it would just disrupt the whole situation. And so we asked people about it, and we evaluated how people felt about it. And what we found is that people actually liked having weapon screening, that it made people feel a lot safer, and it certainly didn't deter anyone from seeking treatment. So I'm going to stop there, and then afterwards I'll be open to questions. Thank you.
So what are we doing here? Good afternoon. So my job is just to wrap things up in terms of the presentation. So I'll make a few comments, mostly in line with what Jeff was talking about, but thanks to Renee for that fascinating presentation and clinical work on the front lines. And I have nothing to disclose. So let me pose three questions that are very similar to the ones that Jeff had been talking about, add a little more in the way of suggestive information about them and remind us all about some of the results that he had. So to begin with, this very, very fresh data from Connecticut that Jeff was talking about, but a little bit different. He has a sample of 85,000 cases that are people who have been seen, not necessarily hospitalized in Connecticut, in one of the state facilities. And 20% of them have a felony conviction sometime in their lifetime. And about 20% have been convicted of a violent crime, not the same 20%, but some of these were misdemeanors. So one comparison is from a study I did of the prevalence of felony records in the state of Illinois, just among the adult public. It turns out to be 4%. So this is just to confirm that this is a population, who seen in the state facilities, has a relatively high prevalence of violence and of felonies. There's an international study I found that looked at 18 high-income countries. And found some statistics on the percentage of the homicides in those countries that were committed by someone who had a diagnosis of schizophrenia. And the answer was about 7%. And one of the interesting things, 7% being much higher than the prevalence of schizophrenia in any of these populations. And 7% was the number plus or minus right across the board. And these countries had very widely differing homicide rates, which supports Jeff's point that mental illness is a contributory factor, but it multiplies together with many other factors, including weapons, in determining what the homicide rate is, but way overrepresented in this population. All right. So that's the first. The answer to the first question, mental illness does have a close association. Doesn't necessarily have a causal association with serious violence. The second question is gun disqualification as written into the Gun Control Act of 1968, predictive of violence and crime. And I want to emphasize here how obvious the logic is. If you look at the disqualification, involuntary commitment is usually based on an imminent danger to self or others. So these are people who have been judged to be dangerous. And why then would we want to arm them? You know, just on that basis, it seems like maybe statistical analysis is not necessary to come to this conclusion. It has this face validity that is very strong. And the other category is the adjudication category, and often that is tied to a court proceeding around the particular crime where somebody is not guilty by reason of insanity or whatever. And again, it has this self-evident quality to it that you would say the logic tells us, yes, this makes a lot of sense. And certainly what Renee was telling us about the 72-hour hold for people who are dangerous to themselves or to others, has the same quality to it. So there's a kind of a high threshold from one perspective that says the logic of this is very much in favor if we care about saving lives for keeping the guns away from folks that are judged to be dangerous. The regression results that Jeff presented using the Connecticut data, and remember these are the data for a smaller sample, 22,000, who were actually hospitalized for mental illness. And in that analysis, there's no difference in gun crime, particularly following hospitalization and after adjusting for time. And that difference that he was looking for and which failed to show up is the difference between voluntary hospitalization and involuntary hospitalization. So putting the information together, you would end up saying this is a group that does have highly elevated risk of violence, but there's no distinction between those that are voluntary and involuntary that shows up for whatever reason in the likelihood of subsequent gun involvement. It is true, though, that other predictors are strong in this arena. All right. Now, a third question is, does mental illness disqualification save lives? That actually turns out to be a different question than the question of whether the particular form of that disqualification is predictive. You could take any group of people and disqualify them from owning guns, and it might save lives. So it's interesting to ask whether this particular group, if we disqualify now that we have disqualified them, would that matter? And the logic that it would save lives, given our current framework, is laid out here in the simplest of all logic diagrams. So the first link is that serious mental illness then, in fact, does lead to disqualification. The second link is that the disqualification is recorded in a database that then could be accessed in connection with a gun transfer or a gun possession issue. And then the third link is that having that information in that database would deprive the person of the gun, ultimately. So you have to have at least all of those three, and of course you also, it has to be for somebody who is inclined to use a gun in violence. So the first link, I guess the thing to be said is it happens, but it's haphazard and it's highly variable among states. And the second link is that the mental illness records are now well over a million in the federal database, but it's still very incomplete, and most states very much incomplete. And the third link is that between having it in the federal database and leading to the block on a gun transfer, is it will only block a gun transfer if the person in question decides to buy the gun from a licensed dealer. And if they happen to have a gun already, or their spouse has a gun, or that they can buy a gun from a neighbor, or they can borrow it from their cousin, the point is there's many, many other ways that a person who was disqualified could get a gun. All right. Jeff's preliminary findings on gun crime is that for disqualified mental patients, it is true that the likelihood of a subsequent gun crime is less after Connecticut improved their NICS records on mental illness than it was before. The problem is that the point estimate, while it's enough to be interesting, is not large enough to be statistically significant. So it fails statistically. As a policy matter, it actually would be enough to justify the policy, quite possibly. And so the chore there is to see whether or not we can sharpen up that estimate and it survives that process. All right. So let me just also talk about another sort of evidence in Charlie. Years ago, Jens Lidwig and I published an article in JAMA evaluating the Brady Act. And the Brady Act was the effort, the long-term effort by Jim Brady and Sarah Brady to implement the provisions of the Gun Control Act that banned different kinds of people from owning guns. And the idea was that before the Brady Act, in most states, people who wanted to acquire a gun from a gun dealer would fill out the 4473 form, they'd lie on it, they'd sign it, and then they'd get the gun. And that would be the beginning and the end of it. So it was the lie and buy strategy, which occurred to a great many people. It was available. That then was blocked in some states by state law that required a background check, and the Brady Act required this of every state. So initially it only affected handgun sales by federally licensed dealers in the 32 states that did not already have this in place, and the initial requirement was a 5-day waiting period in addition to doing this background check. In 1998, then, there was a second set of provisions put into place, and this is what's now in place, which is that all types of guns are included. So whatever type of gun is being sold by the gun dealer, there has to be a background check. There's no more waiting period by federal law, but dealers must conduct this instant background check using the state or FBI systems like the NICS. And then if there's any question about, you know, the identity of the person they find in NICS, is that the same as the person before them, then that the default is that in 3 days there will be a transfer. Okay. So here's what we did. We took advantage of the fact that this is a natural experiment. The 18 states that already had the requirement of a background check served as a control group before and after, whereas the 32 states that for the first time introduced background checks then were the experimental group. The experimental group, which I call the treatment group, is the blue line, and the control group, the 18 states that already had it, is the control group. It turns out, going up to the time of the implementation of the Brady Act, those two states had almost exactly the same homicide rate involving people over 25. That's just a coincidence. There's no need for that to be true, but it happened to be true. Not only that, the two groups of states were tracking each other very closely over the years going up to 1994 and the implementation. So if the Brady Act were effective, what we would expect is that the treatment group would then experience a reduction relative to the other group. And as you can see, if anything, the reverse happened. So there is no evidence from that the Brady Act had any effect on homicide. And when we looked at suicide, it's a little harder to see because there is a gap between the two. But once again, the two groups of states track each other perfectly over this period of time, and they continue tracking each other following the implementation of the law. So once again, there's no evidence of any effect. So what do we get from that? Is a bit discouraged. This law was the work of many years and a great deal of sincere effort. The plausible explanations, though, maybe give us a clue about how to go forward from here. One is that those background checks that are mandated by the Brady Act are only as good as the records that the licensed dealers are checking, and they were woefully incomplete at the time it went into effect and are doing better now. The obvious thing is that the informal market by which something like 40% of all gun transfers happen is unregulated by the federal government. So it is not just a loophole, but it's kind of a gaping barn door in this whole regulatory apparatus. The question then is, what has happened since then, and is it more effective now? Okay. So just to summarize and wrap up, the logic for the ban is very sound. It speaks for itself. The dangerous self or other or not guilty by reason of sin. Those sound like terrific reasons for keeping somebody separate from something as deadly as a firearm. There's no, so far, direct empirical evidence that the ban is effective. I would say that's where we are. But the work that Jeff showed you is, I think, state-of-the-art, and it's evolving. Tune in next year. Maybe we'll sharpen up those standard errors and have something to talk about. I don't know. And I think there's the philosophical issue, which is pretty interesting, and I'll leave you with that. And that is, we're all, I'm sure, in this room, believers in evidence-based policy. The question is, what is the null hypothesis that needs to be rejected by the evidence in this case? So one possibility is that we preserve the ban just because it makes sense, unless the evidence is strong that, in fact, this group is safe. And the alternative is that that it's so important to preserve gun rights that we don't put a ban on any group unless there's strong evidence that they're dangerous. So depending on which position you take, you think that the current law is right on the money or not. All right. And disregard it.
Why don't we come up to the front and we have time for just a few questions for any of us or comments from the audience. Thank you very much. Anyone? Yes, ma'am.
Hey, Dr. Binder. I'm assuming as an inpatient you were mandated to notify the police about these patients that have guns at home. If I'm a clinician, I see this person after discharge and they reveal they have guns, do I have a legal responsibility?
No. No, it's at the time of the hospitalization.
Yes.
I have a general question for the panel. How do the research and the policies that are in place account for those who don't have access to mental and behavioral health services and therefore are not undiagnosed? I don't think they would show up in any of those cases. So how does that become important?
Right. Well, I would first start by agreeing with you that certainly if you have a policy that is premised on searching records of people who have actually participated in mental health services, behavioral health services, and you have people outside that system, it obviously is not going to work. And in particular, there's also the same problem for people who might be at highest risk in the period right before they first become known to the system. For example, in the meta-analyses of first episode psychosis, a significant number of those individuals had them. So I think that is that's a very good point, and I think that the question is what is the alternative? And because given that there is a constitutional right at stake, the idea of having an adjudication, an adjudicatory process where there's due process, because an individual might have their rights taken away, then you kind of need to have people who are sort of in the system in some sense. Thank you.
And this also, Jack was commenting on being over-inclusive or under-inclusive. So you raised the point of being under-inclusive. I mean, I mentioned that when I started about that both President Obama and Governor Romney said we're not going to give guns to mental illness. And I had such an intense reaction to that because what is mental illness? I mean, there's so much stigma. And are they including people who have some anxiety or some depression or, go to see a therapist because a loved one died? And, they should have said, one of them did, people who have been involuntarily hospitalized because they are a danger to themselves or a danger to others. But not because they happen to have a psychiatric diagnosis, which an awful lot of people have.
Just a comment on that. I think this is an issue that puts people like Dr. Bender in a bind, because, you know, you can hear it in her voice. She is against discrimination against people with mental illness, and she's against promulgating these very offensive stereotypes that people with mental illness are dangerous. On the other hand, I think you'd probably rather have the argument about discrimination, about something else that's guns. Because, you know, on the other hand, you probably, at least many mental health professionals, think there are too many guns out there and would rather that you know, we reduce the number. 300 million guns in private hands is too many guns. So so that if they're in this bind of wanting to say, let's not discriminate against people who are dangerous, without also being back into the corner where the question is, so you're saying we should give more guns to people with mental illness. Maybe we should not give more guns to anyone. So that's the kind of tension, I think, that is underlying this argument.
Well, we can say there's discrimination in housing, and there's discrimination in employment, and, you know, and all sorts of things. This is another example.
Right.
Other things are huge.
Right.
Let me just add to this a very interesting point. So it has come up not so much in the question of gun transfers recently, but certainly in the question about who should be allowed to get a permit to carry a concealed gun. And the old tradition was that the local sheriff had discretion about to whom to issue a concealed carry permit in a lot of states. And that discretion could be then exercised as the sheriff saw fit, but including by looking for character witnesses and doing a background check if they were very conscientious. That background check could have produced a lot of evidence that somebody was dangerous or that they were acting strangely in various ways, which would have been enough then, again, with the image of the conscientious sheriff to say, in your case, we don't care that you don't have a formal record, we're not going to let you have a gun. So that kind of human discretion then, to a large extent, has been removed, but I think that in some ways, when it was exercised properly, it made a lot of sense.
There's probably some states that do have a culture where the police have more and do exercise more discretion in permits, where you know, the inquiry comes from the chiefs of police to the mental health system, but they have more, you know, in some states, just they exercise more discretion about it, I think.
I think there's 8 of them left.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
I want to bring up the issue of suicide. I'm not quite sure where to begin exactly, but I think it was triggered in part by this woman's comment about your legal obligation as a clinician, and it seems clear to me that the connection between youth firearms and youth suicide is a strong one, and that anyone who's treating young people or their families, if a kid is depressed or involved with substance abuse, needs to make the recommendation actively or ask the question, do you have guns in your house? And if you do, it's a good idea to get rid of them or store them somewhere else. So that's one piece. And I'd like to hear comments about that. Then the other end of the spectrum, which I guess is a direct question for you, is anyone who is suicidal necessarily have a mental illness? I think we have a huge cohort of elderly people who have easy access to firearms as a way to exit when they've decided it's time to exit. I've got this chronic disease, or I don't want to deal with this, or whatever. And where we go with that as a society in terms of making policy and so on and so forth, I think, fits with what we're talking about.
Well, I'll take a quick stab at the second question first. And that is that what you said is certainly borne out in the statistics from the CDC, particularly among males and white males as well, that the risk of suicide goes up substantially, significantly, you know, towards the end of the lifespan. If you look at the data from the National Violent Death Reporting System, that tries to really look into what factors were present in, you know, after a gun-related suicide. I think that, as I remember, slightly over half of those suicides were people where there was an identified mental health problem, and a similar proportion actually were in treatment, had a treatment record. With that, that's interesting, but it leaves a lot of people who have, you know, committed suicide, for whom there's no record of a mental health problem or treatment for mental illness. So I think the provocative question, though, to me is, if we assume that, let's say, depression and late life depression is a treatable disorder, and that properly treated, that individuals who might otherwise be inclined to end their own life might actually improve in their life quality and status and mental health condition and have more years of life for themselves and their family, well, maybe then the question is, you know, not where is the gun, but where is the treatment, and why isn't that made more available, particularly to groups like the elderly and college students and veterans and, you know, and so forth. So I think that's a good point. You may have something to add.
Yeah, just in terms of your first question, I mean, there's a law that says that you know, someone is hospitalized, you take the gun away from them. But before there was a law, you know, you still don't let, you try really hard if people have medications at home that they can use as an overdose. If they have guns, knives, I mean, you talk to people about removing things from the home. In the case of an adolescent, you talk to the family about it. And you, I mean, whether there's a law, whether there isn't, and you try and develop an alliance with the patient, you get other people involved, and you know, whoever needs to be involved in order to try and make the person safe. I think the difference now is that there's the force, but it's also you're not allowed to do it, but whether that makes any difference or not.
And so could you just mention the subgroup finding in your JAMA study with respect to older people and suicide? I know you don't feel too strongly about it. I think it's relevant to this discussion.
It certainly is relevant. It is true that in the JAMA study, our overall effect on suicide was that there was no effect. And yet, when we broke out the group that was 55 and older, there did appear to be an effect in the expected direction of the Brady Act. So I would say that I'm kind of 60% convinced that that's right, but it is a strange pattern of conclusions.
And people commit suicide for all sorts of reasons. I mean, you know, people who certainly are diagnosed with mental illness, you know, have seen, you know, their parents die in mental illness, commit suicide at quite a high rate. People with ALS
talk about it. And,
you know, that's not what this call is meant to deal with. And those people often do not come to psychiatric hospital for psychiatric treatment or medication.
Hank,
I wonder if you might comment. In your regression model, I think I saw, well, it was a lot of data, that a major relationship was with co-occurring substance use disorder.
Correct.
And it's, I think, was embedded in a couple of different things you presented, but when you talk about risk factors of mental illness, because the violent crime correlate is co-occurring substance use disorder. Mental illness by itself isn't much of a factor. It's almost always together with co-occurring substance use disorders. So I just wondered if you would comment a little bit on that, because it seems to be in your data, but the conversation hasn't talked about that very much.
Yeah, so certainly if this were a session entitled, what are the risk factors for violence in people with mental illness, that would probably be, you know, point number one, because, you know, the MacArthur study and just any study I've ever been involved in, co-occurring substance abuse is a very significant risk factor, and it can interact with mental illness in a number of different ways to increase violence. There's probably a pharmacological effect in increasing aggression or decreasing inhibition. It could well be that it exacerbates high-risk psychiatric symptoms like paranoid persecutory delusions, makes those worse. It could be that people who use substances, illegal drugs, are exposed to environments that are criminogenic, and it could be that it affects, you know, relationships and other kinds of things. So there are lots of reasons why that is an important vector, you know. And I think that with respect to policy, it just shows that if you throw everyone into the same boat on the basis of involuntary commitment history without considering individual risk, that it's going to be a kind of a blunt, indiscriminate indicator. Now, there is some thought that with respect to how we think about restoration of gun rights, I mean, that's becoming more relevant in the Nixon Proven Act context, that individual risk factors would be brought to bear. But that's an interesting discussion, because you only consider the thing that got you disqualified, or do you then consider more broadly other things that might contribute to this public safety determination that's in the law? So, but that's a good point. Thank you all for. Oh, we have one more in the back.
Just about maybe reframing the issue around mental illness and gun and acquiring a product that is associated with lethal outcomes. Do we have an opportunity to look at some other indicators that are not so enmeshed in privacy issues and challenges and stigma and so forth, linking it to things that are just very straightforward in some cases, like drunk driving? You're misusing a product under alcohol. What gets you to have access to another product that could have lethal outcomes? Or are we always going to have this meshness? You know, I have a constitutional right to access this product versus I don't have a constitutional right to access a car.
Well, no, I think that opens up a whole box of Pandora's. Because, but behind that question is this larger philosophical consideration of autonomy versus paternalism and civil rights as the posture. If you start with the civil rights perspective, and that's the default, and you say, you know, you really have to meet a high bar to abridge someone's right, then that's why, you know, the gun issue is significant. If you take a more of a kind of public safety perspective and say, well, let's think about what's in the public interest, and, you know, certainly we live in a country where people are allowed to do things that are not in their best interest, but on the other hand, there's certainly a place for sensible regulations, and you know that's what public health law, you know, is about in many ways. So I think that's certainly a good point as well. All right. Well, thank you all for coming.